Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my special guest is Andres Bernal. Andre was born in Bogota, Colombia, and emigrated to the USA as a child. He now lives in New York City and is a lecturer at City University New School of Labor and Urban Studies. Andres is a leading advocate of the Green New Deal and modern money theory, and he writes, campaigns, advises on public policy, economic theory, social justice and climate change, and leadership. Andres, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Good. It's a real pleasure. So you're linking up a few things here, and I'm very interested. You and I have known each other for a good few years, and I've been following your kind of engagement. You're into economics, you're into kind of money, and you're into leadership. That's quite a combination. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the story that led up to me looking for a way to integrate those fields and themes together started from when I had a very formative experience in a leadership development institute when I was younger. And that focused a lot like on the role of social narratives and social logics for how we understand ourselves in the United States, particularly in the Latino and Latinx community. And so that had a big impact on me. And I was always interested in just kind of turning back and thinking about how that might play a role in groups and people that want to see some kind of change, even if it's at a personal level or also on a bigger kind of political institutional level. And then just from my own interests outside of that, I was very focused on learning about the economy, learning about politics. Part of that was because I was an immigrant to the United States, and my father was also politically active when he was younger in university. So, you know, I kind of went off to graduate school interested in finding ways to integrate those two fields and themes of my life. So I started graduate school at a leadership studies program at the University of San Diego, where I was introduced to leadership perspectives from the kind of psychoanalytic group relations world, from the developmentalist world, from the network and systems theory world. And I thought that was like super fascinating and really important, but I was kind of still longing for a way that could most effectively be applied to the biggest political issues of our time. Climate change, inequality, the rise of and radicalization of the far right, these kinds of questions, which at first I don't think I was totally satisfied with the way that those ideas were being applied, whether that's in the consulting world or the coaching world. And, you know, I really enjoy those worlds professionally, but I thought there was something lacking there. So I ended up going off to New York City to study policy. And that just coincided, to circle back, to go full circle to that story, that Latino Latinx Institute, when I was younger, had introduced me to a young woman named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And we had become good friends in our 20s. She lived in New York City. So she was one of my first friends when I moved to the city. And after the election of Donald Trump to the presidency here in the United States, she decided to run for Congress. And it was a very long shot kind of, very ambitious campaign that at first seemed like an impossible thing to achieve. And so I was on that campaign as a policy advisor, kind of linking her to innovative policy perspectives and communities who were talking about economics in a different way from the orthodoxy, from the mainstream, that were more ambitious on the policy level and that were kind of looking back to the United States, to the New Deal era of Franklin Roosevelt and the Economic Bill of Rights, as well as some of the insights from the civil rights movement, what we call here as the unfinished Reconstruction. So, you know, after slavery was abolished, like that unfinished story. And that ended up very much becoming part of the Green New Deal and the job guarantee agenda here in the United States. So I started to find really interesting ways as I became a scholar of modern money theory and heterodox economics more generally. I started to actually realize that there was a huge space for leadership theory to be an influential part of how we think about the economy and policy.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So interesting. And of course, AOC, as she is now known, has kind of become very famous and doing some pretty impressive work is it in the Senate now?
No, she's still in the House of Representatives, you know, but one could imagine that she has the presence and influence of a senator.
Yeah, she's very impressive. Yeah, that's quite a story. I mean, I've always been very interested in, I came into this world through the people work, through sort of psychotherapy and family therapy, and then going into kind of organizational consultancy, and then getting interested in systems and leadership, you know. But I've always been kind of a bit bewildered, really, how these things get siloed, you know. So if you go and study leadership studies, they do case studies, like the Harvard Business School way of working is like, go away and do a case study, and you study an organization as if it's kind of a closed system outside the kind of the social world, and they and that's kind of what our leadership theories have been built on, and organizational theories, and even in the group relations world, I always found it kind of interesting to do the work, always interesting, but kind of where's society, kind of where's wider society, kind of where's the politics, kind of where's the kind of environment in this, and again it was kind of studying a closed system, like a small ecosystem. So the links you're making, I think, are really important.
Absolutely. It was very interesting because prior to studying leadership, I was a philosophy major in my undergraduate, and I was just looking at these big social questions, political economy, macroeconomics, critical theory. And then when I was studying leadership, as you said, right? Yeah, we were learning these case studies. And what I ended up discovering was there were things in these group systems case studies that were missing. Where is society? Where are these political questions? But then also in the world of politics, there was a missing set of work around how do people work in groups together, how to manage authority, just the questions in government and social movements. Why do social movements break down? Why is there so much burnout? How can we make public agencies expand their administrative capacity? These questions were oftentimes ignored because, and this kind of also goes full circle, because the field of orthodox mainstream economics had in a way colonized political science, policy, and economic thought, to where everything was being conceived of as this very rational actor based perspective, where there wasn't room for the unconscious, there wasn't room for desire, there wasn't room for a multiplicity of rationalities and culture and all of these other elements, I think, that are so key to groups and systems. It was just kind of like everybody's out to satisfy their own presence, their own preferences, and that works great for the market, but it's not good for government, so we need as small government as possible and as much market as possible, because that's the only way that that supply and demand curves will probably work themselves out.
Yeah, and in the economics, I mean, I noticed there was actually kind of a recognition in the last decade or so of kind of emotions. But again, it becomes like a kind of a rational psychology applied to economics, you know, so you get kind of nudge economics and stuff, you know, how can we kind of like apply some kind of rational psychology and kind of shifts people in this direction or that direction. It's not this kind of wider libidinal economy. I'm and you talk about when we think about the unconscious and desire and kind of what drives kind of, politics. I mean, I think observing the rise in populism they really tap into it, but in a kind of devastatingly bad way. Like,
I mean, this one question that we, many of us have, I think, in progressive circles, of why, you know, quote unquote, why do some people vote against their self-interest if they're kind of, you know, not super wealthy, working class, or even low, very low income, and yet they support and vote for very authoritarian and right-wing political leaders that, you know, implement policies in the benefit of a ruling class or an elite. And I just felt like the answers to those questions, both from the mainstream and from the left, were not that satisfying to me. And that is when I started to turn to more like of the emotional, unconscious level, where almost as if there isn't necessarily some illusion, some false consciousness that once people tap into their true position in class, they were going to vote differently and finally be awakened. And it's just like, no, there are underlying emotional, unconscious forces that are very real. They're not distractions. They're not false consciousness. This is just part of the many discursive, emotional, and libidinal forces at play that we need to address more directly, I think.
Yeah, I think it's vital. I mean, it raises a couple of questions for me, and I want to have this conversation with you. Have you read Chantal Mouffe's work around? So she believes that the left should create a populist left. What's your thinking about that? I mean, that's a big debate on the left, whether they should go populist or kind of oilist.
Yeah, that's quite a question. I mean, in many ways, my involvement in the Bernie Sanders campaign was kind of my first answer to that question, which was yes. And I think after two, depends on how you look at it, unsuccessful versus perhaps somewhat successful campaigns, my answer is a little different now. I think we need to deconstruct what we mean by populism, because as we see, I see this around the world, but certainly in the United States, even that force for a progressive populism had all kinds of dysfunctional dynamics that ended up hurting the movement. And in the United States, a big part of that was a huge tension around whether some of these social justice components were as legitimate. I would say social justice components, I would say kind of liberal individual rights components, were just as valuable and legitimate as the kind of class-based organizing. And there was a real difficulty to see how these things are not in competition, and they're actually all part of just different ways to think about advancing society, moving it forward. And there's a big part of what was that original populist movement that just like does not want to open up to these parts, right? And it's very rooted in like the civil rights movement in the United States. So for a while, when AOC endorsed Bernie, it felt as though we were actually uniting those things, right? Yeah. Intersectional social justice and also economic justice perspective with the kind of more old school left populism. But all that ultimately fell apart in that moment. Now, I continue to insist that the Green New Deal as a framework in the United States does provide the opportunity to accomplish these things in an integrated way. But I do think that we need to rethink policy and economics, and especially money, which is something that I've become to kind of develop somewhat of an expertise in to do this.
Yeah, and I'd like to come to money later, but I want to stick on the libidinal economy. It's, I mean, this is very interesting to me. When you think about the civil rights movement, when I think about the labor movement I grew up in the UK, the miners' strike, the class war, which is going on basically when Maggie Thatcher was around, there was a very strong libidinal economy. There's this very strong class consciousness and identity, a struggle, which we felt part of. Now that seems to have dissipated. And although, like, if you study kind of any kind of any form of deprivation when it comes to health or education. You know, economic kind of status is kind of right at the heart of that. Like, you know, it's the biggest indicator of any sort of deprivation. And yet it seems that there's kind of a loss of class consciousness, a loss of libidinal economy kind of in that class. And that's been diverted into kind of identity kind of politics, it seems. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very fascinating and important question. You know, in the 60s, some of these critical theorists that influenced me were talking about how the Soviet experiment had not produced the results that people imagined, and that social democracy had complicated the conventional criticism and expectations of what capitalism would do and wouldn't do. And I think part of that is what complicates this idea of a class consciousness versus identity, because I think social democracy really made clear that there is a lot of heterogeneity to economic institutions. There isn't, and to class, there isn't kind of a flat experience of
of
one thing that we could call a working class or one thing that we could call a worker. For example, one criticism that I share here in the United States is that there's a tendency, and I think that this applies especially to the Anglo countries, there's a tendency to imagine, as you mentioned, this class consciousness almost as like the image is this construction worker kind of white working class. And oftentimes repressed or ignored is all of the heterogeneity about what a worker is, who a worker is, you know, women and all these other marginalized communities. And so there's a tension there between these different identities who have been marginalized economically, yes, but also culturally and in other ways as well. So it's a real challenge, I think, that we have to. And this is, I think, where leadership obviously applies, right? To be able to hold these two tensions between groups that had been pushed out of any even working class, stable working class experience that the social democratic transformations of the mid-century were able to give a white working class.
Yeah,
because that's
yeah.
what the civil rights movement was largely about. People were like, look, the government did all of these things and even formed a coalition with Southern racists to find some stability, but you left all a bunch of people out. Sure. And so to have access to higher education, to have access to union participation, all of these things became legitimate. So that brings up a bunch of very, very interesting questions. Today, we're seeing it also with the LGBTQ community, who historically, you know, didn't even really have a lot of space to exist or to exist publicly, to be able to feel safe at home in their home, in the home life or in many other public institutions. And so I think to understand that those concerns are just as legitimate as fighting inequality and fighting for stability of all people as workers and also not as workers, right? In homes, in other places, that's the challenge.
Yeah, and it's a real challenge. I mean, diverse groups, marginalized groups, oppressed groups, like you say, kind of didn't find a voice in some of the kind of working class movements. And yet, without working class movements, you get Trumpism. You know, you get kind of a white working class, and not just a white working class, a Latino ex working class as well, and a middle class. Kind of often following kind of those types of politics because there's a lack of kind of solidarity elsewhere. So it's kind of there's a huge lack, and it's like how do you get solidarity with diversity is a question we're struggling with on the left, isn't it?
Yeah, I my theory and the way I bring money directly into this is that part of the problem is that when we discuss these attempts to bring more to working class, the conversation is very much paralyzed into this zero sum kind of worldview whereby we want things for the working class, and so we have, the only way to do that is to tax somewhere and recycle that money somewhere else. And so I imagine that is like this very contracted framing.
Yeah.
And what you see is that the counter organizing to this, the counter politics to this progressive agenda, is to just label working class people as taxpayers, as the taxpayer identity. So immediately what you end up having is people who think that their personal wages are literally being taken to pay for poorer people or for the homeless or for the safety net. And this kind of zero-sum framing, I think, has very much intensified the gap between the lack of solidarity amongst different groups, because everything is understood as a very self-standing, separate type of configuration. What I started to discover is, like, first and foremost, that's actually not the way that money works at national macro levels. It's not this zero sum framing, and there's a huge history here from the Second World War, from the contributions of Keynes and other institutionalist, progressive, liberal, and even socialist thinkers and economists. And so I kind of came to the conclusion that part of the last 40, 50 years of what we might call neoliberalism was to really make concrete and real, naturalize a zero-sum commodity theory of money, where it's scarce, it's finite. If you're going to use it for something, you have to take it from somewhere else. And every single time we try to do progressive things, elites just point to the working class and the middle class and say, look, you're never going to get enough from us, so you're going to end up having to take it from them, and then they get upset and they don't want it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's been hugely successful, that kind of
that
politics, and it's been massive. I mean, like the Labour Party in the UK now, they had quite an ambitious, it wasn't quite a Green New Deal, but it was a big kind of move towards that, and already they're kind of withdrawing and saying, like, because of this kind of zero sum money thing, you know, we can't overspend, and they're already kind of like making adjustments and saying it can't be done because, you know, straight away.
And it's even the left side of the Labour Party that does this too. I mean, I following them, a lot of them even fell in line with the sound finance. We will also be responsible with our debts and deficits. Yeah. So even the left is under this neoliberal kind of Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan framing. And I find the NHS a great example of a success story of the 20th century, and that wasn't built through this thinking.
No.
Yeah, not at all.
No, that's right. It's like, you know, you're in post-war, you've got absolutely nothing. The country's been blown to bits, and you get the biggest kind of social welfare, social housing, kind of health, kind of movement, you know, because the politics are there and the kind of faith is there and the spirit's there and the liberal economy is there to let's do this thing, you know.
Yeah.
Let's make this happen. Like, you know. The other thing about the left is, like, when we talk about liberal economy and like the emotional kind of economy of politics, on the left and on the and also in our group relations world, I find there's a kind of tendency to pathologize. You get kind of what I call wounded self politics. So you come from a kind of victim state status, and it's kind of the big other is always persecuting us, and it's one of the other underpinning kind of ways of thinking, which I find very problematic, because there's loads of really bad stuff going on, there's loads of things to kind of fight and struggle for, and yet where is that kind of energy, and where is that kind of drive, and where is that kind of the inner kind of belief to kind of make that kind of difference, which was made in those post-war years in the UK or around kind of the NHS and stuff, you know, where does that come from? Because I feel that's kind of dissipated.
I agree. I think that part of that is the lack of having a politics of creation and a politics of institution building that we managed to kind of start to develop during that mid-century era. almost because like we had no other choice. I mean, we were fighting the Nazis. I have a colleague who wrote this great video essay about full employment and how full employment has only been realized when we had a clear enemy in the Nazis. And so this notion that society could be fully employed at the, you know, at the formal economic level, but also at that libidinal level, made sense when we were fighting a war and when we hated certain people. And it was like, you know, we can only be loved and held when it's for a war. But full employment has not been able to be mobilized for anything else, to save the environment, to address inequality. And so what we have is kind of only struggle and the anger and the woundedness and the depravity and the abandonment that comes with the status quo, and especially the economies of austerity that have dominated the last 40, 50 years. So, you know, again, why I think the Green New Deal and that framework, that kind of full employment, big public spending, public job creation approach is key, because that is about institution building. That is not zero sum. That is, and when you bring in money into this, and we can talk, we can explore this further, right? When you understand the way, as you mentioned, I mean, I think that was beautifully put. The UK, the United States had gone through the Great Depression. Britain was blown to bits. How do they muster to find money to rebuild and build these institutions? Because money is not a private, finite thing. It's this public utility that simply organizes what is real, which is mm-hmm. people and resources and technologies and the will and the desire to build stuff, to create things. And that's really what transformed the world in the mid-20th century. That's really what gave us the best of social democracy. And so I think we need to like find a way to tap into that again, because that's, I think, the healthy version of the struggle with also the celebrated aspect of institution building.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And, you know, just listening to you reminds me again of kind of the European Union and what they did to Greece, you know, the politics of Greece and actually the kind of the debts they were in. It was kind of the European Union's kind of fault anyway. We took them into the European Union kind of early before they met some certain conditions economically. So it was always a mismatch, and Germany sold lots of its kind of cars. We all sold stuff to Greece and we gave them loads of money to spend. And like, you know, and then when they couldn't repay, we kind of, the European Union just absolutely hammered them and left them in this sort of economic deprivation, which kind of has opened a door to kind of right-wing politics and left them for like generations in trouble. When actually it was a kind of a small amount of money. I mean, they can bail out the banks through political choice when they needed to bail out the banks and get, you know, when COVID came, it was amazing kind of where money was created kind of to do certain things to save companies, you know, it was there all of a sudden, you know, but for Greece when it's suffering, no, sorry, you know.
Sorry,
it was,
never there.
It's these political choices become very kind of clear when you kind of, observe it in a different way.
Yeah, whether it was the war in Iraq or from the United States and, you know, the coalition of the willing, as they called it back in the day, or bailing out banks during 2008 financial crisis, or COVID, when the response is needed and they decide and whoever is controlling these fiscal decisions and these budget decisions, when they decide that they need to spend, that's what they do. They just spend. But when it comes to things that are really important for people that have been deprived of valuable resources, then we go on to this endless debate about where are we going to find this money. And so I think it is becoming more clear. This issue around because obviously one of the common responses whenever people push for just spend the money so we could create value, social value, people say, well, you know, that's going to destroy the value of these currencies. And they point to Weimar Germany and even to Greece, who doesn't have that. They lost their own currency. They had to give it up to join the EU, which is a big part of the problems for many of these countries. They gave up their currencies to join the monetary union, but then the EU doesn't really provide any fiscal stimulus ever. So what are you supposed to do?
That's right.
So people draw attention to Weimar Germany and inflation and all these problems. And so I think, at least here in the United States, the last 2 years of inflation price issues that we've had have also presented an opportunity to rethink that, right? And look at the way that this image of too much money, which I think invokes a kind of panic that is associated with too much of what's deemed and defined as a social undesirable. So, you know, people will often point to or associate with the queerness in Weimar Germany after before the Second World War, right? All the way that queer politics arose, right? Sometimes it's connected to different people of color in different countries who are associated with crime, for example. So like this inflation panic is usually like there's going to be too much of this undesirable energy around us as well. Society is going to collapse and these other people are going to take it over because everything is going to be worthless. I've had colleagues make the connection of too much money, too much genders, too many races, too many, you know, it's this too many. But when you really look at what happened in these circumstances, I mean, it was really the loss of access to resources, or in, you know, Germany's case, going through this war that destroyed their infrastructure and then having to repay other countries in their currency. You can think of like the genocide in Zimbabwe and the bloody revolution there that really hurt their agricultural capacity. Or during COVID, the way that this public health crisis completely disrupted all these global supply chains that were already designed to operate through like this just-in-time paradigm where you don't store for darker times, you don't save up, you just do just enough. That brought a lot of big profits to these kind of like monopolies in food and in different kind of raw materials. So when the shock happened, not only were these industries not prepared for it, but their workers were all worn out, tired, sick, didn't have access in a lot of places like the U.S. to good healthcare. There was a vaccine apartheid. And then on top of all of that, which caused a shortages, bottlenecks, so things couldn't get shipped around. So yeah, of course that's going to raise prices, raise costs and things. And then on top of that, evidence after evidence has come out that all the major companies took advantage of the situation and just charged people more as well.
Sure.
So it's this much more complex thing than the common image of like too much money, everything's going to be worthless, forcing us to look at the bigger picture, the networks, the context, et cetera.
Is there some, I mean, I was interested in your connection between the Weimar and kind of queerness and I was thinking about queer politics and something about surplus jouissance where like there's a, when pleasure breaks out, you know, when there's a kind of a breakout of pleasure, when people can actually find themselves and be themselves and the LGBT community kind of celebrates itself and can express that sort of pleasure in their own identities. That seems to trouble an awful lot of people as well. Yeah. It's like there's a real kind of a kickback to that, isn't it? Like, you know, like this thing which is celebrated by many suddenly kind of threatens other people. It's a strange kind of phenomenon, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think what's important to note there is that, you know, whatever is understood as surplus, you know, the normal level of jouissance is politically and socially constructed. It's not natural. And I think like that also has been difficult across the ideological board to understand, you know, because like Lacan borrowed that concept from surplus value and Marx in that sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been some really interesting anthropological theories of value that really challenge that kind of classical economics, 19th century notion that, you know, value is internal to people getting into contact with each other. I'm looking for a term here. Immanence. Value is immanent to the economy, to people, as opposed to a holistic view where there's all these institutions at play. They are designing the borders or the limits of who gets to participate, what do workplaces look like, where do investments go, what are the laws, what are the legal frameworks, who's getting credit, literal money credit, but also credit in a larger sense. All of these things are being shaped and designed at a more macro level, as opposed to, I think, this classical view that everything is immanence and it's just coming from direct contact. So I think then, both in the cultural sense of what's surplus and then in the economic sense of what's surplus, we tend to ignore or repress everything that's designing the norm. The investments. And it's just, I think it's fascinating that investments means like literal, you know, money investments, but also the cultural and libidinal investments.
I find all this fascinating. I've been thinking for quite a long time around kind of pleasure and jouissance and kind of how that engages with politics. I was writing those papers on the meaning of Trump and the meaning of Brexit and Boris. And it seems to me that when one group takes hold of its pleasure, when it kind of manages to celebrate itself and find that part of itself, it seems that there's another group which is thinks that their pleasure has been stolen, like the finances, the money policy you're talking about, zero sum. It's like, you know, there's only so much kind of pleasure can be had, and if they've got it, then we haven't. You know, if immigrants come over here, it's because they're stealing our jobs, they're stealing our pleasure, they're stealing our work. These things are kind of very, very linked. And also that concept that Khan talked about, pleasure and displeasure. There's a lot of people take pleasure in kind of harming themselves. You know, yes. Their vote Brexit. They know that Brexit's kind of really, they know that it's going to economically damage themselves, but they vote it to show the elite kind of what yes. they're made of.
You know? Yes, yes. And you know, my colleague Scott Ferguson, who's at the University of South Florida, he's kind of made this his area of focus, where he challenges, and this is very related to the wounded self, celebrated self, that kind of dichotomy, but he kind of challenges the way power has become the only thing we think about when it comes to politics, power being very much, as you mentioned, right? Like, how do we show them? How do we struggle? Who's being abused? But what that's doing is it's repressing the historical role of care. To borrow kind of a Heideggerian term, like sorge, which was kind of care, this idea of maintenance, the need to feel cared for, to be cared for, to care for things so that they reproduce themselves, is a kind of an addition to this idea of power. But care is also really important. And I think, like, you know, there's a huge lack of care in our politics. I think some of these things, some of these symptoms you're speaking to, touch on this. Oftentimes care is just gendered as like only what women do in the household, right? But care is this society-wide really important thing that all people need and have access to, sometimes inadequately, which is a really, really important part and related to the politics of zero sum, the politics of you take my joy, it goes somewhere else. I think that's all very connected to what institutions and infrastructures of care are we providing and investing in.
Yeah, and I think in the USA in particular, I think kind of Europe social democracy has kind of done a little bit better, but like the harshness of the US is kind of stark in its lack of care for marginal groups and economically deprived groups, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the history of segregation and communities that sometimes are called ghettos or whatnot, right? Or the hood, the way people describe them. And it's just places where there's a total absence of care. Yeah. History of public housing in the United States, where they built it up and then they just, I mean, this also speaks to the importance of care being ongoing. It's not just like a one-off thing. So much public housing in the United States was built and then nobody ever cared for it again. And people expected those that live there on like low wages or suffering from unemployment to do it on their own. And so you have all of these communities in urban centers across the United States that are now being pushed out into the suburbs that have never been cared for. And yes. So that's why the Green New Deal and a lot of the policies that I focus on are about full employment and about like really trying to offer care through employment. Employment as the job, but employment as the libidinal sense of you're employing your resources, your social connections, your role in the community, all of these sort of things that are so vital to human thriving.
Yeah, and I mean we could do a whole other podcast, and maybe we will on what work means, the meaning of work. I mean that idea of full employment. You know, what does it mean to kind of work? I think that's another really big question for the 21st century where we are now. You know, to rethink that. You know, to kind of you know, for years there's been some things called work and some things kind of not called work, and right. Kind of where is that dividing line, and kind of what does it mean to be kind of an engaged member, an engaged citizen, kind of employed? What does that kind of mean today, and what will that mean with AI and stuff? I think that's a whole kind of other question which I think is going to be really important to kind of find answers to.
Absolutely, it's really key, because you know a lot of folks have been kind of emphasizing on the idea that AI and technology is going to automate everybody out of a job. And I think what's often ignored in those conversations is, again, this history that when we needed to employ people, that's what we did. There's still a choice to what we want people to do, what we think they should do. And it's not all at the whims of markets and technology as if they had a consciousness. Well, maybe right. AI does have a consciousness, but as if we didn't, you know, right. as if we didn't, as if we couldn't make decisions about what we want to do and how we want to define work. And ultimately, I think the other thing I'll say about, you know, the role of libidinal economies and of psychodynamics in many of these issues of the economy is that I think the human experience is complicated when we really wrestle with the question of interdependence, because I think, like, you know, classical and mainstream economics only makes sense if everything is understood from a place of separateness and individuation, and people coming in contact from a place of separateness and individuation, and that's such a problematic and lacking. An alienating way to understand an economy. You know, heterodox economics looks at an economy as a social provisioning process. And I really love that definition, because social provisioning process kind of leaves room in my eyes for many of these deeper emotional aspects of life and the heterogeneity of these different processes that come about. So I think wrestling with interdependence is difficult. You know, you're born into a world where you immediately depend on others. So many of these questions about what is work, how do we work, how do we employ, where do we invest in, is really connected to this question of how do we live together. And that's been hard. Yeah, that's been difficult.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, it's really core to my work now. I use the word interdependence so much, from dependency to interdependency. It's kind of I'm working in the humanitarian sector at the moment, and I also draw a lot on sort of Donna Haraway and another kind of ecofeminists around the idea that we are kind of connected to nature in a way. We're so interdependent that to get that right, to kind of, and the Green New Deal is part of this, to understand our interdependence with technology, with nature, and with other beings, human beings, and our multi-species companions, other kind of animal life, which we're destroying on this planet. You know, once that shift towards interdependency and understanding that is kind of absolutely fundamental for us to kind of survive and to thrive, I think, to our well-being. It's not just like a good thing or a bad thing or an altruistic thing. For me, it's absolutely core to our kind of our well-being and our survival.
It really is, and I never feel like I emphasize this enough. I mean, the people making the majority of the rules and the narratives believe in the complete opposite, and that is mainstream economics. They literally believe in the complete opposite. There is no room for any of this. We are all at the whims of people maximizing their self-interest, and that is the only thing that, according to them, will bring these market equilibriums or whatnot. And every now and then, there's a market failure, and then that's when we can come in and maybe fix it a little bit. But a theory of interdependence is much acknowledges the embeddedness in which we're all in with technology, with nature, with ecosystems, with other animals, with the built environment. There's so much more there to be thought about. And what's important to me is the role of mediation. And I mean that in the sense of governance, rules, money, law. These things all shape the kind of interstitial elements of those connections, those interdependencies. And that's what's difficult. But I think, like, going back to, like, where is the boundary on jouissance and when is it surplus, right? Like, these things are all up to us to decide and what we want to value and et cetera.
Yeah. Andres, this has been fascinating. Thank you very, very much. I've got two final questions I ask my guests. Through your life experience and your work, what thoughts have you got about what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
I'm drawn to this book called Emergent Strategy that I'm looking at here while you asked me that question by Adrienne Marie Brown, and one of the things she brings up as an element of emergence is this idea of things being nonlinear and iterative. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we live with intentionality, understanding that life is nonlinear, and that it's important to kind of try again, fail, learn, and keep going. Is a big part of this process of living a good life, and contributing to a good society.
That's really, really thoughtful. And I align my own experience with that. So, thank you very much, Andres. Really great to speak with you. And, I look forward to doing some work with you in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been a huge pleasure.
Take care.